the bitch. So then it came about that Mut'im Innit, the proud, in the degeneration worked by her passion, fell low indeed, letting herself in for a course of action which her natural refinement would only a little while before have rejected with disgust. She sank to the moral level of Tabubu the Kushite, and combined with her to deal with the unclean, in other words, to make magic spells for the binding of her lover, and to sacrifice to a horrible netherworld deity whose name she did not even know or wish to know. Tabubu simply called her the bitch, and that was enough. This nocturnal spectre, it seemed, was a perfect ghoul and fury, but the negress promised to make her compliant, by means of charms, to the wishes of Mut the mistress, and Mut was fain to be content, on the understanding that she renounced her claims to the soul of her beloved, and would be glad if she might but hold his body, a warm-blooded corpse, as it were, in her arms. Or not glad precisely, but mournfully assuaged. For of course it is the body, the flesh alone, that can be conjured in this wise, and delivered into anybody's arms, not the soul at all. One needed to be very inconsolable indeed to be consoled with that, and with the thought that love's craving and satisfaction is, after all, a matter for the flesh. In God's name, it was easier to dispense with the soul than the body, however mournful the satisfaction the body purveyed. The state of Mut'im Innit's own body was responsible for her finally consenting to the rubber-eater's base proposals. She was fully aware of her witch-like state, and considered that the physical signs it had set upon her were proof that she belonged to the guild, and was bound to act accordingly. We must remember that her new body was a result and product of love, a pathetic accentuation of her femininity. For witchery is at bottom nothing else than femininity raised to an exaggeratedly and illicitly alluring height, from which it follows not only that witchcraft is preeminently female, and male witches as good as never exist, but also that in it love plays a predominant part, is always the very center of the activity, and love magic, as its natural and preferred sphere, comprehends everything that can rightly be called magic. I have earlier, with all due delicacy, suggested that something of the hag had entered into Mut's physical being. It probably contributed to her inclination and willingness to practice witchcraft, so that she now allowed Tabubu to set to work on the business of sacrificing and conjuring. For the deity whom they were to conjure was, according to the negress, the personification of haggishness, a hag god and hag goddess combined, in whom one must envisage an embodiment and epitome of all possible repulsive connotations of the word hag, a being of the filthiest practices, in short, an arch-hag. Such deities there are, and must be, for the world has sides that reek with blood and are stiff with foulness, seemingly very little fit to be deified. Yet these have just as much need as its more appealing sides of permanent representation and headship, of ghostly embodiment, so to speak. Thus it comes that the name and nature of the divine can enter into the horrible, and bitch and mistress be one, especially when it is the arch-bitch we are dealing with, having by right the characteristics of a mistress, in any case. Tabubu, when she referred to this embodiment of all filthiness and obscenity, actually called her the gracious mistress-bitch. The black woman thought well to warn Mut that the nature and conduct of the proposed operations were quite outside the great lady's social sphere. She begged pardon of her refinement beforehand, and implored her for just this once to adjust herself to the tone of vulgarity, because it was all that the gracious mistress-bitch could understand, and without a certain indecency of speech there would be no dealing with her. The proceedings would not be very pleasant, she said. The ingredients for the conjuring were some of them most unappetizing. Nor would there be a lack of imprecations and bombast. The mistress must make up her mind to that, and not take offense, or if she did, she must conceal it. For this act of compulsion would differ from the religious services to which Mut was accustomed. It would be frightful, violent, and high-handed. Not even in intention did it proceed from the human side, or in accordance with human tastes, but from the gross nature of the being they invoked, whom they summoned to their presence, the mistress bitch, whose service could not be other than obscene, and whose character as arch-hag conditioned the form of the proceedings and their very low level of decency. After all, in Tabubu's opinion, if you were setting about to constrain a young man to a purely physical compliance with the demands of love, there could not be a very high tone to the business. Moot paled and bit her lips, partly from the shock to her conventions, partly also from hatred of the evil chance which forced the compulsion upon her as well as on him. Now that she had resolved, the baseness of her resolve was a wound in her thoughts. That is a very old human experience, that when a man is tempted to fall below his better self, his tempters, those who drag him down, alarm him and mock him when they have him safely below by the insolence with which they suddenly speak of his new and unfamiliar state. Pride demands that he conceal his fear and bewilderment, that he answer them, "Let things be as they are. I knew what I did when I resolved to follow you." And in such wise did Moot express herself, taking up an attitude of defiance to a resolve originally foreign to her nature, the conjuring of her beloved by means of magic. She had to be patient for several days. The Black Priestess needed to prepare her magic, for which not all the ingredients were to hand. Rarities like the rudder of a wrecked ship, uncanninesses like wood from a gallows, rotting flesh, certain parts from the body of an executed criminal. Most important of all, some hair from Joseph's head, which Tabubu had to procure by craft and bribery from the household barber shop. Besides, they had to wait for the full moon, for their work would be more fruitful if performed under the highest potency of that equivocal planet, which is feminine in reference to the sun, masculine in reference to the earth, and thanks to its double character, guarantees a certain unity to the universe, and can interpret between mortals and immortals. Besides Tabubu as priestess, and the Lady Moot as client, there would assist at the conjuration a Moorish acolyte, and Mek-en-Weset, the concubine, as witness. The flat roof of the House of Women was the theater of operations. Each day, whether feared or longed for, or fearfully longed for with impatience and shame, comes on at last, and becomes a day of one's life, bringing what it has to bring. So came on the day of Mut-Im-Enet's hopeful degradation, when in her bitter need she betrayed her station and embarked upon her unworthy course. She awaited each hour as she had awaited each day, conquering one by one. The sun sank, its glory faded, the earth was shrouded in darkness, and the moon, incredibly large, rose above the desert, substituting its borrowed luster for that of the departed sovereign sun, and for substantial daylight, the frail web of her painful, pallid magic. As slowly diminishing, she mounted to the zenith, and all was quiet, while in the house of Potiphar everybody lay with drawn-up knees and peaceful faces, sucking at the breasts of sleep. Then the four women, alone in the house awake, with their mysterious feminine purposes, foregathered on the roof, where Tabubu and her assistant had already made the needful preparations. Mut-Im-Enet, her white mantle round her shoulders, a blazing torch in her hand, hurried so fast up the steps which led from the fountain court to the low upper story, and thence by a narrower one to the roof, that Mech, the concubine, with her own torch, could not keep up with her. Annie began to run directly she quitted her bedroom, holding aloft her fiery torch, her head flung back, her eyes fixed, her mouth open, her garments caught up in one hand. "Why run so, darling?" murmured Mech. "You will be out of breath, I am afraid. You are stumbling. Stop! Go carefully with the torch!" But Petipre's chief and true wife answered disconnectedly, "I must run. I must run. I must storm these heights breathless. Do not stop me, Mech. The spirit commands me, and so must it be. We must run!" Panting and staring, she swung the light above her head so that sparks of burning pitch flew off from the flax, and her breathless companion clutched in alarm at the whirling stick to wrest it away. Moot would not suffer her, and the danger was the greater. They were now on the second stair, and Moot really did stumble when they came to grips, and would have fallen had not Mech grasped her arm. The two women, thus embraced and flourishing their lights, staggered through the narrow door and out on the dark roof. They were greeted by a wind and by the voice of the priestess, who took command from the first. She carried on the talk from that moment, without ever stopping for breath, and it was gross, domineering, bombastic, ever and again interrupted by the howling jackals from the bleached desert on the east. Yes, from farther away by the dull, shattering roar of a ranging lion. The wind blew from the west, from the sleeping city, and from the river, where the moon played in silver sparkles on the water, from the shore of the dead and the mountains on that side. It was caught, panting, in the wind chimneys that faced the west, a sort of wooden roof designed to divert cool air down into the house. There were also a few cone-shaped grain bins on the roof, but besides these usual things were many more objects and preparations, the properties for the performance. Among them certain things on whose account it was well that the wind was blowing, for on the floor and on tripods were pieces of bluish, putrid flesh, which would have stunk, and did when the wind died down. The other objects for the dark rite a blind man might have seen with inward eye, or a person who, like Mut-Im-Init, did not want to see anything, since then and thereafter she gazed diagonally upwards into space, with her mouth drawn down half open, and staring eyes. For Tabubu described them all aloud. She stood there, black and naked to the waist, her head a gray mass of tangled hair disheveled by the wind, girdled with a goat-skin under her hag-like breasts, as was her young helper likewise. Her loose mouth, in which two lonely buck teeth stood up, moved ceaselessly as she shouted the name and use of each object, like a market-woman crying her wares. "There you are, woman," she said, as she gestured and pointed, when her mistress staggered under the roof. "Welcome, scorned one, seeking protection, poor languisher, husk rejected of the stone, love-sick trull, come to this hearth. Take what we give you. Take grains of salt in your hand. Hang laurel on your ear. Crouch by the hearth where it flickers in the wind out of its hole. It flickers for you, to your healing, poor soul, so far as may be. I speak. I spoke. Here above I spoke and said as priestess before you came. Now I speak on, loudly and grossly, for fine words avail not to wrestle with her. One must name things shameless by their names. Wherefore I now name you aloud, supplicant, a fool for love, and a trollop bewitched. Are you sitting with your salt in your fist, the laurel over your ear? And your companion, has she hers, and is she too crouching by our altar? Up with us, then, for the sacrificial rite, priestess and ministrant, for all is prepared for the meal, gifts and adornments without flaw. Where is the table? It is where it is, facing the hearth, fittingly adorned with garlands and branches, twigs of ivy and blade of corn, that she loves whom we invoke, who approaches. Dark husk hiding the mealy kernel. Therefore it garlands the table, and trims the stands whereon the tempting offering stinks to heaven. Does the rotting rudder lean at the table's side? It does. And on the other side, what do we see? A beam from the cross whereon they raised the malefactor on high. In your honor, perverted one, who favors that which is rejected, and to allure you it leans beside the table. But do we offer you naught else of him who was hanged? No ear, no finger? Yea, the mouldering finger graces the table, with fine crumbs of bitumen, and the gristly waxen ear from the miscreant's head, clammy with blood. All that, so richly to your taste, may it bring you, unholy one. But the knots of hair that shine upon the offertory table, like in color, they come not from the murderer's head, but from other heads near and far. And we have them lying close together. May they be fragrant to you, if you will help, you on whom we call, you who come out of the night. Still, then, let no one budge. Ye who sit by the hearth, keep your eyes on me. Blench not, for no one can tell from which side she will creep up. I command silence for the offering. Put out this torch, wench. So, Where is the double-edged blade? To hand. And the cur? It lies on the floor like a young hyena, with chains on its claws, with moist muzzle bound, that snuffs with such delight for every kind of filth. Give me first the bitumen. The ready priestess throws it in black crumbs on the flame, that its leaden, qualmish smoke may curl up to your nostrils as incense, O mistress of the nether world. The drink offerings now, the vases in right succession, water, cow's milk, and beer. I pour, I pour, I pour. My black feet stand in the liquid, the pool, the bubbling lake, while I perform the sacrifice and slay the dog. A loathsome rite, but it is not our choice. We only know that it is dear to you. Bring him on, then, the sniffling cur, the obscene beast, and slit his throat. Slit his belly and bathe your hands in the smoking entrails as they steam up into the cool, moonlighted night. Smeared with blood, dripping with entrails, I hold them up to you, my hands, for I have made them in your image. I salute you. I invite you humbly to the sacrificial meal, O mistress of the hosts of night. Courteously we entreat you, solemnly we beg you, graciously share the meal, accept the flawless gifts. Does it please you to accept? For else know that the priestess will rise in strength against you, will seize you violently with bold practiced clutch. Approach, come springing from a noose, or from pressing hard the woman in labor as she groans, from the caresses of self-slain wives. Come, blood-smeared one, from the haunting place of corpses, to gnaw their flesh. Come, lured thither by your cankered lust of the impure, from unclean clingings at the crossroads where the malefactor lies. Do I know you? Do you know yourself in these my words? Do I wrestle nearer to you in your essence as you are? Lo, I know you in your works and ways, your unspeakable practices, your monstrous eating and drinking, and all your bottomless lusts. Or shall I come to you with closer grips and plainer, and my mouth forget its last restraint, naming you as you are in all your swinish essence? Uttermost horror, cleep I you, bitch and strumpet. I rail at you, pus-eyed nightmare, rotten fungus, slavering slut of hell. You that perch at home on gallows where the criminal is flayed, squeaking and squalling and slobbering as you gnaw the carrion bones. Last lust of the hanged, wet-wombed receiver of his erected agony, yet weak with vice, unnerved and abject, quaking with every breeze, starting at spectres, to all things of the night a cowardly prey. Uttermost horror, know I you, name I you, have I you, see I you? Yes, it is she. For lo, a cloud darkened the face of the moon, and while it was veiled, she came. The dog that bays before the house bayed louder. The blaze flared up from the hearth. The handmaid there of her who invokes you writhes in a fit. Where she bends her gaze, whither her eyes roll, thence approaches the goddess. Sovereign, we greet you. Graciously be pleased, for we have given of our best in gifts. If then the impure offering appease you, help. If the unclean meal, aid us, we pray. Help her, the despised and languishing. She groans for love of a youth who will not as she will. Help her as you can, as you must. I have you in ban. Torment him hither in the flesh, the reluctant one, till he come to her on her bed, he knows not how. Make smooth his neck to her hands. Let her once slake her longing with the sharp smell of his youth for which she yearns. Now the hairs, quickly, wench. The love offering, the burnt offering I now perform in sight of the goddess. Ah, the bright locks from heads, one near, one far, so soft and shining. Waste matter from your bodies, I, priestess, weave and wind, mingle and marry them in my hands, bloody from sacrifice. I knot and net, I twist and tie, I let them fall into the flame, and flame consumes them, crackling. Why is the face of the suppliant one writhen with horror and disgust? Is it the evil, horn-like smell of the burning offendeth your nostrils? 'Tis your own substance, my delicate one, essence of your ardent flesh, the odor of love.